we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO on unceded and ancestral Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, and Squamish territories in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, September the 29th. 2023, and we recognize tomorrow, September the 30th, as the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation here in Canada. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here by my co-host, Jen Dobell.
Hello.
Hi, Jen. Welcome back to the show. It's been a while, and we are happy to have you here.
Thank you.
So we have an exciting program coming up for you in the next hour today. First, we are going to address the state of the grizzly bears in BC. As you may know, BC had implemented a province-wide ban on the atrocious trophy hunt of grizzly bears in 2017, and that ban has been in effect since then. Well, now the government is calling upon the public for comments to help draft a new grizzly bear stewardship framework, and some wildlife advocates are concerned that this could be the beginning of reinstating the grizzly bear hunt. We'll have biologist and campaigner Amber Peters from the Valhalla Wilderness Society on the show for our first interview to let us know about what is happening and why we need to be concerned and act. Then for our feature interview, we were able to cross off a longtime wished guest from our bucket list, at least on mine, Jen. I don't know about on yours. And Jen and I have been reading an anthology of stories of the life of one of the world's most dedicated and fearless animal and environmental activists on the planet, who is Canadian-born and made his early life home here in Vancouver. He's the co-founder of Greenpeace, the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and now the founder of the new Paul Watson Foundation, and is continuing his strategic and brave work in fighting for the oceans and the animals as his life mission. We'll be presenting a feature interview with Captain Paul Watson. And if you want to get a head start on his latest memoir, take a look for the book called Hitman for the Kindness Club, which just came out this summer. That interview is coming up in 22 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. So, Jen, thank you for being here today. It's been a long time since we've been on the air. It's good to be back. There's just so much happening in the animal and vegan advocacy world since we did our last live show. But this week, we want to acknowledge a special someone who touched the lives of many.
Yes, Cornelius the Turkey, who was a resident of Happily Ever Esther Farm Sanctuary in Campbellville, Ontario, has sadly passed away this week. I follow the sanctuary on social media, run by Derek Walters and Steve Jenkins and all their volunteers. And Cornelius captured my heart as I watched countless videos of him running towards his caretakers, wings outstretched for hugs, trying to push the other animals off the laps of Steve and Derek so that he could get in for a hug. And, you know, if anyone doubts the sentience and the emotional capability of animals, watching these videos would surely turn you into a vegan. And so I just want to read a tribute from one of Cornelius's human dads, Steve Jenkins. Today, I said goodbye to one of my very best friends. Within weeks of Cornelius's arrival at the farm, it became very clear that he had a mind of his own and an attitude to go with it. He would follow our piggy princess all over the farm, leading the way on our walks and waiting at the sliding door in the backyard when we got home. He came from a place where he was best friends with the man who raised him and later found out that Corno would escort his human around their property wherever he went, just like he did when he moved to the farm. He was a people turkey, but not all people. For a while, sanctuary caregivers would come collect him from the back deck while he pecked and picked fights with whoever was tasked with escorting him back to the barn. Needless to say, it was only a matter of time before I caved and he was invited inside. From that point forward, Cornelius was a house turkey, a member of the family, and self-appointed security guard for Esther. Cornelius completely changed my perception of birds, much the way Esther did for pigs. It wasn't that he was special. He was special. That's besides the point. It was because he was allowed to be himself and to show us who he really was. That's the amazing thing about animals. We can learn so much from them if we pay attention. He was affectionate, loyal, and hilarious. He hated everyone except his chosen flock. And that was just one of many reasons I fell so madly in love with him. He was like a grumpy old man in a bird's body who lived his life on his terms. He made me smile every single day. He was one of my best friends. He was family. I would have killed for one last Corno hug, and although I didn't get one, he did hold my hand while he drifted off to dreamland. Thank you for letting me love you, sweet man. I miss you already, and I always will. And I'm crying right now.
I was crying when I read about this a few days ago.
Yeah.
Cornelius the turkey touched the lives of many.
Yeah. And so for all those of you who haven't heard of Happily Ever Esther Farm Sanctuary, it's named after Esther the pig, who was purchased as a mini pig, which does not exist. That would be like us selling you a human baby and saying, this is a mini human, they'll never grow. Long story short, the couple who adopted Esther found out they were lied to and ended up moving to a farm and creating a sanctuary. And there's a book written about it, and I highly suggest you follow Happily Ever Esther Farm Sanctuary.
And we've had Esther's dads on the show too. Go to animalvoices.org and you can learn more. Just type in Esther the Wonder Pig. Thanks, Jen.
Looking for ways to engage and educate your kids while schools are closed? Your kids can learn from home with SeaSmart's Ocean Defender online courses. Kids age 7 to 10 become an Ocean Defender through interactive virtual lessons and hands-on activities. SeaSmart provides all the resources your kids need so you can work from home with ease. Even better, SeaSmart wants to support you with their Pay What You Can initiative. Visit seasmartschool.com to register today. That's SEA, smartschool.com.
The Greater Vancouver Food Bank has been providing support for our cities for almost 40 years and has been vital to helping thousands of community members through the COVID-19 crisis. To find out how you might benefit from the Greater Vancouver Food Bank's services, or to learn how you might donate money or volunteer your time, please visit their website at foodbank.bc.ca.
For our first interview today, we are joined by biologist Amber Peters with the Valhalla Wilderness Society. VWS is a BC-based wilderness conservation organization specializing in the creation of parks and protected areas for wildlife and ecosystems. This July, the BC government put out a call for public commentary for a new draft grizzly bear stewardship framework that could actually see the return of the grizzly bear trophy hunt, which has been banned since 2017. This call for comments has been recently extended and now goes until October the 6th. As a scientist and wildlife advocate, Amber is here today to tell us about how the grizzly bear stewardship framework could affect our future for our grizzly bears and what British Columbia need to know. Hello, Amber, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. It's such an important topic to start. Can you give us a short history of where BC has been since 2017 in protecting our grizzly bears?
Okay, so as you said, the grizzly bear hunt was finally banned in 2017. At this time, grizzly bears were federally listed as an at-risk species, a species of special concern under the Species at Risk Act. And also in 2017, a report was released by the BC Auditor General at the time, who found that BC didn't have a plan to implement any of their strategic direction for grizzly bears. A huge issue that the Auditor General found with grizzly bear management was extensive habitat loss, lack of protection of habitat, including we didn't have enough connectivity corridors between existing protected areas. And we also have this huge expanse of resource roads in BC. At the time, it was about 600,000 kilometers of resource roads, with about 10,000 more being added each year. And this is highly associated with grizzly bear mortality. So that report showed we weren't doing proper monitoring, and we really didn't know how many grizzly bears that we even had in BC. So with increasing cumulative impacts to their long-term survival, the hunt wasn't sustainable unless we could prove otherwise. And since the hunt was banned then in 2017, which was also, we had a 78% of British Columbians in a poll agree that it should be closed. We have had a small amount of habitat protection take place in British Columbia. That includes the Upper Incomapleu River Valley, which was a campaign of Valhalla Wilderness Societies for 22 years. But we've in no way addressed the provincial scale habitat loss issue and the loss of salmon stocks and this increase in resource roads. So we really haven't fixed the problem. It's only gotten worse since that time.
Hi, it's Jen here. Could you tell us about this new grizzly bear stewardship framework that the BC government is now working on? What is it exactly?
So under the Species at Risk Act, because they are a listed species, we're supposed to get a grizzly bear management plan within 3 years of grizzly bears being listed. But instead, we've been given this provincial grizzly bear stewardship framework through a strategy that the province has initiated called Together for Wildlife. This is a draft document currently, and it's intended to provide information about grizzly bears to local and regional advisory committees that would then make recommendations to the province about grizzly bear management. So the province is supposed to be initiating these local and regional advisory committees to really make management decisions for our grizzly bears, or at least recommendations to the province.
And why is it harmful? Why are some of the questions on the survey meaningless in your mind?
So, yeah, it's interesting because the survey that the province has put out during this public engagement period, it gives us the idea that these local and regional advisory committees that would really be a voice for grizzly bear management, that's already a decision that has been made by the province, that we don't have any opportunity to comment on that, or on the fact that that's going forward. And we think it's incredibly harmful because these local and regional advisory committees would allow local governments, hunting and trapping organizations, guide outfitters, and other vested interests to take part in grizzly bear management. And so conservation groups would, you know, most likely be at the table, but their voices would be drowned out by these louder lobbies that have a vested interest in actually, utilizing grizzly bears or killing grizzly bears and not conserving them. So, yeah, we saw this sort of thing happen with our mountain caribou, and they're in critical decline. It's very dangerous. So in this draft grizzly bear stewardship framework document, there's actually no stated mandate for any conservation action. And so through this process that's being called Together for Wildlife, the organizations that have been working very hard to reinstate the grizzly bear hunt since 2017 would then have a voice in grizzly bear management decisions. And so we believe this would most likely lead to reinstating of the hunt.
And you're saying that those voices, those lobby voices, have a stronger power than, I guess, just regular citizens, the 78% of British Columbians who don't want a trophy hunt because they have money. So I'm wondering, the government obviously knows that, right? So what do you think their motive really is in calling for these comments from the public, knowing that they're going to be getting a large amount from the hunters, the pro-trophy hunters?
Yeah, so, in this poll, most hunters actually believe that we should close the grizzly bear hunt, too. So most hunters agree that it's not sustainable or unethical or whatever their reasoning is. Yeah, the province seems to, initiate these public engagement processes to, I suppose, help us feel that we're part of a democracy, but it seems that they have a plan already in place, So we do go forward with encouraging engagement because we need to show them that we are large in numbers as well. But, yeah, as I've said, some of the questions in the document, they really allude to the fact that they've already made their decision up about these local and regional advisory committees, and that's the real dangerous part.
Well, you're a biologist, and I appreciate having your expertise on the show here. You've been talking about how, grizzly population numbers weren't known. Right as of today in 2023, 7 years after the trophy hunt ban has been implemented, and also in the aftermath of the most destructive wildfire season ever in BC, what are you as a biologist seeing about the state of the grizzly bear population today?
So we still don't know how many that we have because we're still not doing proper monitoring. Many independent biologists have long felt that BC may have significantly less grizzly bears than it estimates. But since the hunt was banned, what we do know is that threats to their long-term viability have increased, including these massive fires, which completely devastate the habitat, continued clear cutting of old growth forest and expansion of resource roads. And then we are seeing, for example, these starving grizzly bears on the coast. I think that was in 2021 that we had a really bad year. And that's because of decreasing Pacific salmon stocks. So these cumulative impacts to our grizzly bear population are increasing, are expected to increase. And so even though we don't have proper monitoring in place, we need to use the precautionary principle and understand that these animals are under greater pressure than they ever have been. And yeah, in this document, it really understates the importance of old growth forest to grizzly bears, but we know that it is important. And there's, even a suggestion that if salmon stocks are low, bears can eat berries, but or vice versa. But we do have years where both are completely limited. So with the scale of habitat loss that we're experiencing now, we know that these bears are going to be under greater pressure.
Right. So again, you study bears. I'm wondering, what have you come to know and appreciate about the grizzlies? Can you tell us more about their personal lives with their families? Where do they live exactly in BC? And why do the grizzly bears matter?
So, I mean, another thing that we do know about grizzly bears is that while we do have a significant number of grizzly bears in British Columbia and in northern Canada, their habitat range, their original extent, which extended down into Mexico and through much of the lower 48, that has contracted so much. Their range has contracted so much that probably I think it's about 50% or more. So we hardly have any in the United States now. They're no longer in Mexico. And this is a trend, that we're seeing their range contract. There's the dry Okanagan interior region of the province no longer has grizzly bears, or much of it doesn't. And this is a trend that can continue, very easily. We can lose our species at risk. So where we still do have grizzly bears in BC, they're really an incredible animal. They have a wide home range and occupy a significant diversity of habitats. So we see them utilizing from quite high elevational habitats down into the valley bottoms, wetlands, avalanche paths. They have this huge expansive range, and so because of that we call them an indicator species or an umbrella species, meaning that they give us an idea of the health of the landscape because they do utilize this significant landscape, and they also represent all of the other species that they share their habitat with, because if we can protect grizzly bear habitat, we're protecting habitat for so many other animals or organisms that occupy that habitat. So, yeah, we see them, in the early spring, they come down into the lower elevation valley bottoms and into the avalanche paths as the snow recedes, and they'll eat the very nutrient-rich early spring vegetation, and then they'll kind of follow the food source up the mountain and more into the higher elevation berry patches, at least out here in the mountains in the West Kootenays where I am. So they'll follow that up into the fall. And so they depend on this continuous you know, seasonal cycle for all of these different food sources that they utilize. They're mostly vegetarian. They're opportunistic, so they'll eat whatever they can get. They will eat some meat, but they're generally a very peaceful animal, actually, that we really can coexist with. And here in the West Kootenays, we've done incredible work to install electric fencing around all of our chicken coops and our fruit trees and that, and we've actually largely learned to coexist with grizzly bears. So in some parts of the province, that would really that notion would really scare people, but it's, you know, we're totally able to coexist with these animals, you know, as long as we manage our attractants and we don't continue putting unnecessary developments into their habitat, which displaces them.
And just finally, what should our listeners do now before the October the 6th to advocate for the grizzly bears?
So we have a page on our website. So it's vws.org/grizzly. So we're Valhalla Wilderness Society. And we have just a couple of key points there that we're hoping that people will write into the province. You know, go ahead and take the survey that they developed. But most importantly, write them a letter and tell them these local and regional advisory committees for grizzly bear management are not okay. This is not the way that we should be managing our at-risk species. And let them know if you oppose the grizzly bear trophy hunt being reinstated, because that was actually not legislated. And so that ban could be overturned, and we're really concerned about that.
That is scary. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been Amber Peters, a biologist and campaigner for the Valhalla Wilderness Society based in New Denver, BC. To submit your comments by filling out the questionnaire about the future of grizzly bears in BC, you can find the link at the top of our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, or visit VWS for valhallawildernesssociety.org/grizzly. And the deadline for submissions is October the 6th. Thank you so much, Amber.
Thank you, Amber. Have a good day.
Thanks for having me.
And we have some animal rights related events coming up. On Saturday, September 30th, join a local animal rights activist as they show the public videos depicting Canada's most humane methods of bringing animals to your table. TV Outreach for Animals is a group founded by a former Mercy for Animals undercover investigator, Jeff Regeer, who for years has been exposing the hidden truths of the animal agriculture industry. Group members take to the streets with giant TV screens and speakers, showing the public hidden camera footage from slaughterhouses and factory farms, and dispelling the myth that turning animals into food or any other product is humane. There will be numerous animal rights activists available to speak to the bystanders and lead them to a more compassionate lifestyle. We will put the event info up on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And on Wednesday, October the 4th at 6:30, Hastings and Nanaimo in East Vancouver, animal rights activists will be educating the public on the cruel and unnecessary use of turkeys for Thanksgiving dinner, and we will be giving away some vegan turkeys, my favorite brand, Gardein. Allison, what do you think about those? You like those?
Yeah, they're the best. They're the best. That's amazing. And just for people who don't know, Canadian Thanksgiving is coming up, right?
It is.
October 8th and 9th.
It is. Absolutely. So we want to get people seeing what happens to turkeys to become our meals. And we also want people to know that there is an alternative that I think would fool most people. They wouldn't even know that that was not real turkey. So we'll be giving those away. I don't want a whole bunch of vegans to show up. We would like to try to convert some meat eaters, please. But again, 6:30 Wednesday outside Donald's Market at Hastings and Nanaimo. And by the way, Donald's Market is my neighborhood grocer, and they have a lot of vegan options. They often have cheese is on 2 for $10. I haven't seen those prices anywhere. And what else do we have? This is very exciting. We have a speaker coming to Vancouver putting on two events in October. This is Dr. Michael Clapper, and I'm a huge fan of him. I often play his informative lectures to my clients while I'm massaging them in my clinic. And I often find myself sharing the YouTube videos of his medical lectures with many people in my life, because this is information that you don't tend to get from your regular medical doctor. So he is a gifted clinician, internationally recognized teacher, and sought-after speaker on diet and health, who began his medical practice in BC. He has practiced preventative and nutritional medicine for more than four decades and has served as nutrition advisor to NASA's programs for space colonists to the moon and Mars, I had no idea, as well as Nutrition Task Force of the American Medical Students Association. He's the co-founder of Moving Medicine Forward, which brings nutritional education into med schools, of which they have very little education currently. They don't even have questions on their board exams about nutrition. So he's quite passionate about getting this information out to them. And he's one of the foremost clinician experts on how to use food and lifestyle to take one's health to the next level. So there's going to be two events open to the public. Thursday, October 26th from 7 to 9 at UBC Robson Square downtown. The title of this event is How Do Our Food Choices Influence Our Health and the Health of Our Planet? And then the second event, Friday, October 27th from 7 to 9, Kitsilano Neighborhood House. And the title is Eating Like Your Future Depends on It. I highly recommend coming to these events.
Yeah, so we'll be posting information on that when it becomes available online on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. You're basically getting the very first scoop here.
Yes. So. And if you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on our Facebook page or on our show, you can send us a message on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver.
You are listening to the Animal Voices show on 100.5 FM CFRO on Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. For our feature interview today, we have Captain Paul Watson on the show. Paul Watson is a marine conservationist, master mariner, author, educator, and poet. He is the founder of both the Captain Paul Watson Foundation and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and co-founder of the Greenpeace Foundation. He was born in Ontario and has spent significant time living on the west coast of Vancouver. Paul has been described as the world's most aggressive, most determined, most active, and most effective defender of wildlife. He has received many commendations for his work, including being named the recipient of the Genesis Award for Lifetime Achievement in 1998, listed as one of Time Magazine's top 20 environmental heroes of the 20th century in the year 2000, and commended by Connecticut's Governor Ned Lamont for 50 years as an environmental conservation activist in 2019. It's been more than 50 years now. He's a prolific writer and has authored or co-authored more than a dozen books, including his latest published work entitled Hitman for the Kindness Club, High Sea Escapades and the Adventures of an Eco-Activist, which we will be learning about more today. Good afternoon to you, Captain Paul Watson, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you.
I've been really enjoying your book, by the way. It's such a great read. I wonder if you could first tell us about the Kindness Club when you were a boy growing up in New Brunswick and what the beavers meant to you.
In, this is like 1959. Ida Fleming, she was the wife of the conservative premier of New Brunswick at the time. And she had set up this group called the Kindness Club, which was really sent out newsletters to children to be kind to animals. Albert Schweitzer was the honorary president of it. And so I joined that, or my mother signed me up for it. And then when I was 10 years old, I spent a summer swimming with a family of beavers in New Brunswick. Every day I was down there swimming with these beavers. And that was a great time. And the next summer I went back and I couldn't find them anywhere. And I looked all over. And then I found out that that trappers had taken them during the winter. And that made me very angry. So that winter I began to walk the trap lines and free the animals and destroy the traps. And I guess I've been doing the same thing ever since.
Yeah, it all started as a young boy for you. And I felt when I was reading that it was just like that is inherent to who you are. I mean, it's just like you do what you do. And in your book, you state that I am what I am and I do what I do because of one fateful day in June 1975. Can you tell us about this story about the sperm whale, please?
Well, that was the first Greenpeace campaign to save the whales. We were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, and we thought that all we had to do was put ourselves between the harpoons and the whales and it stopped whaling. And so in June of 75, Robert Hunter and I were in a small inflatable boat and in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel in the North Pacific that was bearing down on us. And in front of us was a pod of sperm whales. And every time they tried to get a shot, I would block the harpoon. And this worked for about 20 minutes until the captain on the Soviet vessel came running down the catwalk and he screamed into the ear of the harpooner. Then he looked down on us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized Gandhi wasn't going to work for us that day.
Mm.
And a few moments later, there was a horrendous explosion, and the harpoon flew over our head and slammed into the backside of a female in the pod of sperm whales, or eight of them there. And she rolled on her side. There was blood everywhere. And suddenly, the largest whale in the pod just rose up and slammed the water with his tail and disappeared beneath the surface. And he swam right underneath of us and came at us at full speed. And then he threw himself up towards the bow of the Soviet vessel, but they were waiting for him. They knew he would do that. They had an unattached harpoon and pulled the trigger at point-blank range and struck that whale in the head. And he fell back in the water. He was rolling in agony on the surface. There was blood everywhere. And as he was rolling about on the surface, I caught his eye. And then he dove again, and I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming at us real fast. And suddenly he came up and out of the water beside us, so that the next move was to come forward and crush us. And as his head rose out of the water and his eye was right there, so close I could see my own reflection in it, I saw something that really changed my life. I saw understanding. The whale understood what we were trying to do, because I could see the effort he was making to pull himself back, and then his head began to slide back into the sea. His eye disappeared beneath the surface, and he died. He could have killed us. He chose not to do so. So I owe my life to that whale. And as I sat there in the midst of the Soviet whaling fleet, and I said to myself, why are they killing these whales? They don't eat them. They're killing them for sperm oil and spermaceti oil, which is used for high heat resistant machinery. And one of the things that it was most prized for was the construction and maintenance of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said to myself, here we are destroying this incredibly beautiful, intelligent, socially complex, self-aware sentient being for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it struck me. We're insane, just totally insane. And from that moment on, I said, look, I'm doing what I'm doing for them, not for people, but for them. And they're my clients.
Yeah, you've always said that the animals are your clients, and we need people to advocate for animals, right? Because all other social justice causes are advocated by those who are in them, but animals are the only ones who need allies, right? And you're their ally for sure. So I want to talk more about saving animals. Jumping forward in your memoir, you know, there's a lot of history between you and the annual seal hunt in Canada, which I think is still taking place. I'd like to get an update on that. You know, you were fighting against that atrocious annual harp seal hunt, and you even fought with the RCMP on the ice floes. Actress Bridget Bardot came out to show her support. Most Canadians we speak to have still really not much of an idea about the seal hunt. I wonder if you can tell us about some of your experiences working against the seal hunt and where we are today with the seal hunt.
Well, I've been fighting the seal hunt since 1974, organized the first Greenpeace expedition there in 76 and also in 77. And in 77 was the year we took Bridget Bardot out to the ice floes off of Newfoundland. And we've come a long ways. Where it is right now is that in 2008, we managed to get the market closed for seal pelts around the world, and especially in Europe. And that pretty much destroyed the market for Canadian seal pelts. And so the quota today is 400,000 seals, but last year they killed 27,000. And the reason that they're not killing that many is they can't sell the pelts. The only reason it continues to happen is because the Canadian government spends $20 million in subsidies to pay these guys and go out to kill seals, and they just stockpile them in warehouses with no way to sell them. So it's basically a glorified welfare scheme, and the seals are the victims.
Yeah, you know, I've interviewed other people on this subject before and talking about solutions, like the solution to buy out the sealers. What do you think of that as an option, and is that going to happen? Why isn't that happening?
Well, that's been offered many times, and then the Newfoundlanders say, you know, that's welfare. They don't want welfare.
They want to kill something to get their money.
Even what it is. For instance, in 94, I actually came up with an idea for a cruelty-free, non-lethal form of sealing, because baby seals lose their hair after 2 and 2.5 weeks. That hair isn't white. It's actually transparent. It's like polar bear hair, and every hair follicle is hollow, so it retains heat. And I had a German company that would buy it from us, and for each seal, you can get 200 grams of hair. And you just take a hairbrush, and the seals actually liked it. I went out and tried it, and they'd roll over, and you could do their bellies and everything, and they liked it. I brought a couple of sealers from the Magdalen Islands out to test it. They liked the idea. Then I returned with Martin Sheen in 1995 to promote this idea. And while we were there, all the Steelers got drunk. They rioted. They came down. They wrecked the hotel we were in. They took me out. They beat me up. Then the Mounties threw me in a plane without any ID or money and just flew me to Moncton and dropped me off. And as these rioters, these Steelers were going down the streets, their exact words were, "We don't want anything to do with a faggoty idea that, like a brushing seal. Seals are meant to be clubbed, not to be coddled." And so the Canadian government just withdrew my permits to do this. I mean, but we were trying to actually create jobs where the seals wouldn't be killed, and the Canadian government got scared because the Steelers didn't like it.
Yeah, it would be too compassionate for them, I guess, to gently brush the seals and maybe get some cuddles. Wow, I haven't heard that story before. Thank you. So what do you think what's going to happen in the next 5 years? Are they going to keep stockpiling, 24,000 pelts in their warehouses? I'd like to know that.
Well, the Canadian government keeps trying to lobby various countries. And the only thing that they have that they can sell right now, believe it or not, are seal penises. It's turned into some sort of tea in the Far East, which is supposed to promote virility. It's based on the fact that a seal has a bone in the penis, and somehow or other, in somebody's twisted mind, that ends up as being a cure for impotence. This is a kind. You're dealing with human beings. They come up with all sorts of bizarre and ridiculous, superstitious nonsense to justify whatever they're doing. All the Canadian government is interested is, well, we can sell this and make some money and, bring in money and, provide jobs. They're not interested in my idea about providing jobs. They'd rather sell, some sort of voodoo snake oil sex potion.
Yeah, that's what it seems like it comes to. And also thinking of Japanese whaling as well. That's been another big accomplishment in your career as an eco-activist or an eco-pirate. And many of us watched Whale Wars on TV as you fought against the illegal Japanese whaling in the Antarctica. I wonder if you can talk about some of the trials and tribulations for you during that campaign.
Well, we started in 2005 to oppose the Japanese whaling fleet in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. It's an illegal whaling operation. And every year we got better at it. So we actually cut down their quotas to only getting 10% of the quota. We saved about 6,500 seals. We finally got them into the International Court of The Hague in 2014. The court ruled that it was illegal. They stopped for 1 year, then they started up again and ignored the court ruling. But we finally shut them down in 2017 because we were simply costing them more money than they could possibly make. I think we cost them about $200 million in losses. And so it's shut down, but it might start up again because they're just completing the construction of a $150 million factory ship. And the only purpose for that is to go back to the Southern Ocean. So we have to be prepared if they return in 2024 or 2025, we have to be prepared to go back there and be there when they arrive again.
And maybe you can, just for our listeners who don't know, maybe you can speak a little bit about under what guise the Japanese whalers are allowed to go out whaling, even though it's banned, and then what it's actually used for in Japan.
Well, they're actually not allowed to go out at all. The Japanese government gives them a permit, but it's banned by international rules and regulations by the International Whaling Commission. And the whale meat has very little use in Japan. It's less than 1% of the people eat it. They've got stockpiles in warehouses, which they call food security in case they run out of food sometime in the future. And so there's literally thousands and thousands of tons of whale meat in freezers in Japan that is not being sold. And they're bringing it in also from Iceland. The whales that are killed in Iceland are mainly for the Japanese market. And what this thing is in Japan is called food security. For instance, they stockpiled bluefin tuna, 10 to 15 year supply of bluefin tuna. And the thing is that the more they stock it and the stocks, what they call the stocks, go down, that means scarcity, and scarcity translates into profits. The price goes up. It's actually called, I call it the economics of extinction, because as the species numbers diminish, the value goes up and people make money on it. So people are actually making money from the extinction of various species.
I guess they wouldn't be doing it if they weren't making money, right?
Well, either two things happen. They're making money as a profit or they're getting subsidized by governments. Mm-hmm. Pretty much the entire commercial fishing operation worldwide is subsidized to the tune of $76 billion every year. So it wouldn't exist without those subsidies. Commercial fishing could simply not exist without those huge subsidies. To go after the diminishing number of fish, you have to build $150 million ships using 100-mile long lines, 100-mile gill nets, giant purse seiners. To do this, you have to get incredibly high loans from banks, which means you have to find more and more fish to pay off these loans. It's a vicious circle. We pulled one net from the Southern Ocean from a toothfish poacher. A toothfish is actually sold as Chilean sea bass. It's not a bass and it's not from Chile, but that's a marketing term. We pulled one net. It was set 2 kilometers deep. We pulled it up. It took 110 hours to pull it up because it was 72 kilometers long and weighed 70 tons. One net from one ship. And there's enough net and drift nets and long lines to go around the world 60 times. That's how much stuff is going into the ocean. And 40% of the plastic pollution that's in the sea comes from lost fishing gear.
Yeah, so there's plastic pollution in the sea, and there's a lot more going on there. You are famously known for saying, when the oceans die, we die. And we are hearing reports of ocean warming this year, in addition to everything else, just rising temperatures, extreme heat that we've been having here in Canada, and drought, and just these extreme wildfires that have been taking over the province around the world. Can you speak on that and what you foresee in the future? When the oceans die, we die.
Well, 2 years ago, I wrote a book called Urgent, Why We Need to Save the Oceans to Address Climate Change. And in 2015, at the Climate Change Conference in Paris, the talk that I delivered was, I said, you know, if we need to save the ocean, we don't have to do anything. What we have to do is leave it alone. Let it repair the damage that we've done to it. We need a moratorium of 75 to 100 years of no commercial, highly mechanized, industrialized fishing operations. The ocean is what regulates climate change. If you look at it this way, if the Earth is a spaceship, it's on this incredible voyage around the Milky Way, and every spaceship has a life support system that provides us with the food we eat and regulates climate and temperature and provides the air we breathe. That life support system is run, maintained by a crew of engineers, and these engineers keep everything working. We humans, we're passengers. We're having a wonderful time entertaining ourselves, but what we are doing is we're murdering the engineers. We're killing them off. And there's only so many engineers you can kill off before the machinery begins to fall apart. You can't kill off the insects and the bees and the trees and the fish and the worms and expect to survive on this planet. The most alarming thing of all is since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton in the sea, these small aquatic plants. They provide 70%, whereas the forests of the world provide 30%. This 40% diminishment is very, very alarming, because if phytoplankton were to disappear from the sea, we all die. We don't live on this planet without phytoplankton. You know, it provides that oxygen in the air that we breathe. And for the most part, people aren't even aware that phytoplankton exists. But phytoplankton is the foundation of all life on the planet. Not only does it produce oxygen, it sequesters enormous amounts of CO2, but it also is the food foundation for every fish in the sea, leading all up to the great whales. And why is phytoplankton being diminished? Because we're diminishing the populations of whales and seals and seabirds, and they provide the nutrients of the phytoplankton. Farmers are, in fact, the whales are, in fact, the farmers of the ocean. Every day, one blue whale defecates about 3 tons into the sea, very rich in magnesium, nitrogen, and iron. That is the nutrients that phytoplankton needs, and that's been very much diminished over the last 50 years.
Hi, Paul. Jen here. A small percentage of the world's population are vegan, and even less than that are doing activism. What would you say to people in the world today, especially those bringing in children who are not currently vegan?
Well, I think that people should embrace veganism as a solution to climate change. I mean, it's, factory farms are killing, 80 billion animals a year, the single greatest contributor to groundwater pollution, the single greatest contributor to dead zones in the ocean, the single greatest contributor to greenhouse gases. That's where we should really start. We should really eliminate that. Also, these factory farms are the source of zoonotic transmission of viruses. Every year, we kill millions and millions of animals. We just euthanize them to keep the lid on the virus from spreading all around to other farms and everything else. Like, pigs are being buried alive, chickens are being gassed. These things are horror factories, and, you know, people don't think about them at all, but they're environmentally, they're death traps for so many reasons. Veganism is the only alternative to that, and certainly any environmentalist who calls themselves an environmentalist has to be a vegan or else they're a hypocrite. Now, On the positive side, when it comes to veganism, 1979, 1980, nobody knew what a vegan was. It's like from the planet Vega or something. Nobody really knew. Being a vegetarian was a difficult thing. But now, of course, you can find vegan restaurants everywhere in the world. You can buy, vegan, groceries. I mean, it's readily available. It wasn't 30, 40 years ago. In fact, it was practically unheard of. So that's a great progress. We've made a lot of strides in that. I think that with the development of plant-based meats, there's also laboratory-engineered meats without having to kill any animals. Well, we can make a difference in that way. But first and foremost, we have to shut down these factory farms and this mass production of meat and the incredible waste of land and that's used in the process. I mean, I asked a fisherman one time in Alaska, I said, if nothing else, just protect the fishery for the benefit of your own children. And he said, in 5 years, my mortgage is paid. And after that, I couldn't give a damn. Why does somebody like that have children? Well, it's because it's what you do. Yeah. Nobody really thinks of it. And the problem in the world today, I think, is about 90% of all the children that are born are unwanted, unloved, undernourished. And that leads to so many, many problems. So really, if you have one child or two child and you don't give them nurturing and education and love, but if you have 10 children and you give them love and education and nurturing, you're actually doing a better thing, really. So it's a complicated thing. It's all not black and white.
Well, what kind of an economic and political system would you like to see in the world today to solve a lot of these problems that you fight against?
Well, I think that we have to have a way to equally distribute resources in a green sort of way, in a way that doesn't impact the natural world. That's the only way it's going to work. A lot of these alternatives that are brought, electric cars, for instance, to me, electric cars are not an alternative to anything because you got to produce the electricity that comes from either coal or oil or other sources, but you're still burning fossil fuels to get it. And windmills are becoming more and more of a problem. I mean, that's what's killing a lot of whales and dolphins and other sea life offshores where they're building windmills at sea because of the incredible impact of seismic pile driving, sending 200 decibel sounds through the ocean, which burst the eardrums of marine life. And so, but we tend to forget that. Oh, we got a solution here. We got windmills. That's not a solution at all. We really need to think these things through. And, there's a lot of people with a lot more, skills and abilities than I have that can do that and are trying in the process to do that. But as long as the world is governed by corporate greed and corporations own governments and corporations control media, then things aren't going to change.
I agree. And I just want to go back to your new book. It is such a page turner. I've been telling the stories as I've been reading your book. You've put your life in danger countless times to defend animals and the environment. You are so fearless. You're witty when you're in situations where most people would be fearing going to jail. You poke fun at the people who are abusing the animals. Can you tell us some of your most frightening memories?
I don't know if I have any frightening memories. I've been shot at and I've been beaten up and that, but I think that's sort of par for the course. You just have to be prepared for that. One of the interesting things is how I got the name Hitman for the Kindness Club is when I was 25 coming back from the SEAL campaign, I stopped to see Ida Fleming in New Brunswick and, she was way retired back then. And she was glad to see us. And coming back from the SEAL hunt, she said, "Well, you've become the Hitman for the Kindness Club." So that's where that title came from. But, the risks to me have never been a problem. I feel that, life is a risk. You have to take risks if you're going to achieve anything. I get criticized because people say, well, you ask young people to risk their life to protect a whale. How can you ask young people to do such a thing? And I said, well, why is that so strange? We ask young people to risk their life to kill people, to protect oil wells, flags, religion, and real estate. It's a far more noble thing to risk your life to protect an endangered species or a threatened habitat.
Yeah, you have that right. It's Allison back here again. I'm wondering, Paul, if you can tell us about the newly formed Paul Watson Foundation and the campaign that you've already started this year against whaling in the Faroe Islands.
Yeah, I was forced out of a Sea Shepherd with a hostile takeover. That's what happens when they get too big, I guess. And I set up the Captain Paul Watson Foundation. The reason I named it that is because that's going to be hard to take that away from me because it's my name. But we immediately reorganized, and within a few months, we got our first ship, thanks to the support of Jean-Paul DeJoria, who's been a longtime friend. And the Jean-Paul DeJoria is a former Scottish fisheries pull boat, and it's got the speed and the strength and the range that we need. And our first campaign was to Iceland this summer to oppose the killing of endangered fin whales. And we arrived in Iceland on June 19th, and within hours of our arrival, they put a temporary ban on the killing of whales. So not much to do then. We just sort of moved on to the Faroe Islands, where we disrupted two grins, which are the driving of pilot whales and dolphins ashore. We saved one pod. We were pursued by the Faroese Coast Guard. We were charged with entering restricted waters when we were told not to. So they fined me $23,000 for that, but they're not going to pay for it. And then they also fined every crew member $600 for illegal immigration, even though we never set foot on the islands. We're appealing that. And the worst thing they did, though, was they got Denmark to force Jamaica to deflag us, to take our flag away. So that's why we haven't been able to return to Iceland, unfortunately. We just, at the end of this month, we'll have a new flag. And we are preparing to go back to Iceland next June to block the harpoons and hopefully shut it down completely. So we also have other campaigns. We're protecting river dolphins in Amazonia. We're protecting turtles and mayotte in the Indian Ocean. And we're doing a super trawler campaign in November off the coast of France and Ireland.
That's amazing work. I'm so glad to hear that. I know you've been posting posts earlier this year on your Facebook explaining what your new foundation is doing now. And you definitely, I guess, you know, when you're ousted from one organization, it takes you about 1 second to restart and do your own thing, right? And that's amazing. And in that vein, I'm wondering if you can tell us about Neptune's Navy.
I'm continuing to do what I've done all along. Sea Shepherd changed their direction, their objectives. I didn't, so I'm continuing to do that. So I set up Neptune's Navy to call it that, but immediately I got challenged by Sea Shepherd claiming that they owned that name too, because I had thought of it when I was with Sea Shepherd. So we recently changed it to Neptune's Pirates, because we know they don't want to be identified with piracy, and the Jolly Roger scares the hell out of the people that we oppose. So we're now officially Neptune's Pirates.
Oh, okay. And you're allowed to use the Jolly Roger, is that correct?
Oh, our own version of the Jolly Roger, not the one that I designed for Sea Shepherd.
Right.
But the Jolly Roger, officially it's translated, it comes from the French, the Jolly Rouge, the pretty red. But every pirate had their own version of the Jolly Roger. We just made our own. The reason I got that, back in the 1990s, when our opposition, the whalers and the fishermen, that were calling us pirates, I said, okay, well, if you want us to be pirates, we'll be pirates. And I am officially a pirate, because in 2014, Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of the United States labeled me a pirate. So he officially made me a pirate, never charged me with anything, but he's on record as saying, well, this man is a pirate. So I said, okay, well, if I'm a pirate, I'll be a pirate.
There was a documentary film about that too. I can't remember, but it had the word eco-pirate in it. I really enjoyed that. I think that came out in Vancouver Film Festival some years ago.
Yeah, we've had three documentaries, Pirate for the Sea by Ron Colby, Eco-Pirate by Chris Dolman, and Watson by Leslie Chilcote.
Jen has a question for you now.
Well, recently Bob Barker passed away, and you had named a ship after him. Can you tell us what Bob Barker meant to you?
I got a message to meet with Bob Barker back in 2009, and I went to meet him, and he said, well, what do you need? And I said, well, we could use another ship and a helicopter. And he says, well, $5 million cover it? I said, yeah, absolutely. He said, I'll make it $5,250,000 to cover the helicopter. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. And I said, we can name it the Bob Barker. He said, no, I don't want you to name it after me. And I said, yeah, but, you know, it'll go a long way if we do name it after you. Other people will see that. And in fact, Sam Simon saw it, and he sponsored the ship too. So, but Bob was very reluctant, but he finally gave in and allowed us to name the vessel the Bob Barker.
And can you give us a glimpse into the current daily life of Paul Watson and what's to come?
Well, right now, I'm living in Paris right now. I'm doing talks and writing and preparing the ship to go back out to sea here in November. And I'm also, I've just put my oldest son into school, and he started last week, and bilingual school here. And my youngest son is two. I actually have three children. One of them is 42, one's 7, and one is 2. So to me, I think it's important because I think that children inspire us. When people ask me sometimes, well, what do you teach your children? I said, nothing. I listen to them. You know, children have a natural intuitive understanding of what the world's all about. Listen to them, encourage them, and encourage their dreams. And I think that'll work out well for the children. My daughter, for instance, you know, she was into all different things. And I said, yeah, that's fine. But I always told her, I said, you can be anything you want. I'm not your boss. You know, you tell me what you want to do, and we will, and I'll support you all the way. And so, no, she's doing exactly what she wanted to do. She also crewed with me on the ships for a number of years.
Wow, that's amazing. Can I crew with you?
Anybody can crew with us. Yeah.
Except I get bad seasickness, but I love the ocean. I love the water, and I would love to fight against the whalers. I'm always so proud of you and your teams when I see you doing that. It's so inspirational, and we're both so happy to have you here today, Jen and I. So just in closing here, I'm wondering if you have any final message that you would like to add for our listeners, those who know Captain Paul Watson from, say, the Whaling Wars, or, you know, your work in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, people who live here in Vancouver, because you do have your roots here, people listening all over, a global message. What else would you like to say?
Well, I think that if people are vegan, they're already doing quite a bit. But also the one advice I would give, especially the young people, is don't let anybody deter your passion. And, you know, if you want to do something, you can go out there and you can do it if you really want to do it. And that's what's really making the difference. Young people, well, all people really, going out and exercising through courage and imagination what they're passionate about. That's all it really takes. And I see so many examples of how the world has become a better place in many ways because of the actions of individuals all around the planet.
Thank you so much, Captain Paul Watson, for today's interview and conversation in France. You are the new author of an exciting memoir called Hitman for the Kindness Club, High Sea Escapades and the Adventures of an Eco-Activist. I encourage everyone to get it now. It's an amazing read. You can also find out more about what Paul is doing these days at paulwatsonfoundation.org. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio on unceded and ancestral Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, and Squamish territories in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We here at Animal Voices modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. Our past shows can be listened at on our website at animalvoices.org and on Apple Podcasts and Google Play. You can also subscribe to us on Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver, and send us an email at info@animalvoices.org. To close the show, we are playing the song Hey World, Don't Give Up by Michael Franti. It's an homage to Captain Paul Watson and all the other earth and animal defenders who persist in the pursuit to save the planet and the creatures within. Stay tuned next for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
Tell me why the grass was greener years ago. I swear it used to grow here. But no more here. Tell me why on this hill all the birds they used to come to fly here, come to die here. And tell me why I need to know. Sometimes I wish I didn't have to know. Oh, you show me. Hey world, what you say? Should I stick around for another day or two? Don't give up on me, I won't give up on you. Just believe in me like I believe in you. Tell me why on the corner all all the kids that used to come to run here, load their guns here, and tell me why it's okay to kill in the name of the gods we pray. Tell me who said it's okay to die in the name of the lies we say. Tell me why there's child soldiers. Tell me why they close the borders. Tell me how to fight disease. And tell me now, won't you please? The only thing I wanna do is to be in the arms of someone who believes in.